Making sense of an unusual weekend in politics. One of the most powerful prosecutors in the country is fired by President Trump, and the president takes to the campaign trail.
The silent majority is stronger than ever before.
We'll explain the latest administration moves and take you inside the rally. Plus, civil rights leaders of the past reflect on the movement of the present.
I admire what they're doing and respect them in this time that the next generation pick up the mantle of leadership. And for my generation to just give advice on primarily what not to do, you know, because we learned that the hard way.
Powerful observations and lessons about what's different now. It's Monday, June the 22nd. I'm Mark Stewart with The Wall Street Journal, and this is What's News. The U.S. attorney for Manhattan is out after being fired by President Trump. Jeffrey Berman's departure comes after an unusual back and forth. The key points in this timeline of the weekend's surprising events start on Friday evening. Attorney General William Barr said Berman was stepping down. Berman said that was news to him and initially refused. He resigned Saturday after Barr told him the president had fired him. We asked our justice reporter, Sadie Gurman, to explain the significance of the shakeup.
Mr. Berman's ouster is a huge deal because the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York is one of the most powerful law enforcement positions in the country. That office is known for being very independent from main justice and for handling some of the most politically charged investigations. In this case, Mr. Berman's office was looking into several of President Trump's closest allies and had brought a successful criminal case against his former attorney, Michael Cohen.
Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Jay Clayton is expected to be nominated as Berman's replacement. Neither Barr nor Berman were available for comment.
Republicans are the party of liberty, equality, and justice for all. We are the party of Abraham Lincoln, and we are the party of law and order.
Cheers inside an arena in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Saturday, as President Trump held his first campaign rally since the beginning of the coronavirus crisis.
No justice! No peace! No justice! No peace!
Outside, critics of the administration demonstrated, mostly peacefully, though with some confrontations. Crowds at the president's rally were smaller than White House predictions. We talked to The Wall Street Journal's Alejandro Lazo about how coronavirus concerns affected the rally.
We went through security ourselves, and we witnessed that there was masks being handed out to every person who walked through the security line, and at least one person told rally attendees to put the mask on, as they went through the security line. Though, you know, after they exited the security line, we didn't see a whole lot of people with masks on. There was a face mask, plastic face shield, essentially being handed out, but we didn't see many people using those either. And there was hand sanitizer being handed out, small little bottles of Germex for people to use. So it certainly appears that there were supplies, personal protective equipment for people to use at the rally, but it appeared to be optional.
Later this week, the president will visit Arizona and Wisconsin. And New York City moves forward today with reopening of some offices and businesses with limitations. Barbershops and hair salons are also allowed to reopen at lower capacity, along with restaurants allowing outdoor dining. Coming up, we'll explain why many big companies are hoarding cash. Many Americans worried about losing their jobs because of the pandemic are keeping more money in the bank to be safe. Many big corporations are doing the same thing in this period where so much is unknown. Here's our markets columnist, Mike Bird.
U.S. companies are still shepherding a lot of cash. They're trying to raise cash mostly out of uncertainty of what comes next. And that's what comes next on two fronts. both with the path of the pandemic and with consumer demand generally. Companies that are able to raise debt to hold some cash are going to be able to better weather any sudden shocks they weren't expecting, as many of them found out during the worst of the pandemic in March. Now, what's interesting with this going forward is that there's lots of different ways companies can spend that cash and lots of different ways that will affect them in the future. If companies find that they don't need it, they might use the cash to invest, in which case you might expect them to have greater earnings in the future and find the debt that they've incurred easier to pay off. But if companies have to use that just because they're losing money, just because they have negative earnings, just because they have fixed costs that they need to pay, then they're going to come out on the other side of this with a lot more debt than they went into it with. Even though it might be a good precaution to raise that cash now, the debt will still need to be paid off, and you might see investors looking at some of these companies and saying, actually, they've got a lot more debt than they did when we were going in here. We don't like them as much anymore.
Later today, data on existing home sales are out. New home sales data come tomorrow. Coming up, we've been speaking with civil rights leaders who fought for change decades ago. We'll hear what they think of today's movements for racial justice. Demonstrators gathered in various cities over the weekend to celebrate Juneteenth and call for change. As we watch the growing protest movement, so too are civil rights leaders of the past. The Wall Street Journal's Lee Hawkins has been speaking with them to see what they think of today's events. Lee, welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It seems like there are some parallels from the past, but yet this current atmosphere and this current movement is also very different.
It's very different in the sense that the traditional movement was rooted more in the church. The church was the ground zero for planning and coordination of the civil rights movement, even training. Dr. King, Fannie Lou Hamer, all of these hyper-visible, iconic figures who were working in the South got people together and organized them, including students who came from up north to work. They still were working in the church, and that was the center. Now it's much more fractured. You see people coming up from social media. You see people coming up from community groups. You see people coming up from the church. You see people coming in from the National Action Network and groups like that. And so all of these parties are forming a collective, but there's no clear leader and there's no hierarchy in the same sense that the pioneers had all of that. And that's a real critical distinction.
One person who you spent some time talking to is Reverend Peter Johnson. He began his work as a civil rights activist in his 20s. He worked side by side with Andrew Young. He told you a story about going to the airport in 1969. Let's take a listen to that.
I was being assigned to come to Dallas. Ralph Abernathy sat down in his office in Atlanta with me and talked about first my militancy and to be careful in terms of the brutality and the lack of respect for black lives and also for black civil rights workers. Andrew Young drove me to the airport the night that I flew to Dallas. When we got to the airport and I got ready to get my luggage out of the car, he said, "Peter, wait." And he said, "Now, Peter, please don't go to Dallas and get killed." He said, "Now, Peter, these people killed the President of the United States. They'll kill you."
What was your takeaway from that story he told you?
Oh, I love that story because it just showed a side of these legendary civil rights leaders that you don't see. That Andrew Young was still very concerned about safety. And that there was a level of fear, but then this courageousness that they had is all we ever see. That we don't see that Andrew Young was this incredibly loving man who was concerned for the well-being of a younger person in the movement who he felt responsible for. That he didn't want to see him go to Dallas and get killed because he recognized that Dallas was a different place. That Dallas didn't have as much of a civil rights movement going on. And so to hear Andrew Young tell him, now don't go down there and get killed, was really, really showed the beauty of that relationship and that mentorship that he offered. And when you see them in pictures together, that love and that camaraderie is there because they all went through this experience as people in their 20s and their 30s who were young and tenacious, and they will always remember this. It's almost like being on a battlefield together. They share those memories.
Like many of the leaders of the past, Reverend Johnson also did not hesitate to give advice to the current generation.
Have control of your protests. People can lose their lives if you don't know what you're doing. Have a squad whose responsibility is to help keep your protests peaceful. Know the people that's in your protests so provocateurs can't come in and take over your protests. Have clear goals and objectives and that the protests can achieve.
That part where he said that it can be very dangerous out there, this is a man who was hit in the face and in the teeth by the butt of a gun when he was a very young man, and his teeth were never really the same. He's had bones broken. So he knows the struggle and he knows how dangerous it is out there. He said he has a heart condition now, but he wouldn't protest anyway unless he knows who's organizing the protest. Because if you don't know what you're doing organizing a protest, it can get very dangerous out there. And once again, that was just an element that for a younger person that you never really think about.
Why was it important for you to look at the past and compare it to the present? What's the takeaway here?
I think it was important for me to look at the past in terms of the present because the past, all of the roots of the civil rights movement are centered in the 50s to the late 60s. And this was where the majority of the progress was made in terms of the traditional civil rights protesting that we're talking about. And there were the question really with me and my colleague, Melissa Korn, was what can we learn from that generation of people? They were highly, highly trained. They were highly, highly effective. They basically heightened America's consciousness and held America to develop a conscience. This was a group of people. If you talk about them being part of the greatest generation, these were the greatest among the greatest of the generation, because these were people who loved America when America did not love them back. So what then do we learn from these people? Because these were people who put their lives on the line, people who lost their lives, people who had their blood, sweat, and tears in this movement. And because of that, they could not afford to make mistakes. And so if there's anyone worthy of learning from, it's this generation. And that's why we did the story, just to get their insights, and also because what do they feel that they're gaining in this generation, and are they seeing actual signs of substantive progress that they can actually be happy about?
Lee Hawkins, I really appreciated our conversation.
Thank you so much.
And that's what's news for this morning. If you like our show, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. We're back with another episode this evening. As always, more stories on WSJ.com and the app. I'm Mark Stewart with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.